song. In my heart, just a simple little tune. But the rhythm.
All right, this is Pirate RC continuing my tour of the music of West Virginia. And right now I'm here with Larry Gross from Mountain Stage. How you doing, Larry?
Great.
Featuring the Mountain Stage Band, under the direction of Ron Soule with vocalist Julie Adams and Bob Thompson at the piano, our special guests, John Paul White, Ray Wiley Hubbard, Johnny Statz and Robert Schaefer, Les Jour Noir, and King Wilkie.
Around the world, it's just a simple song.
Why don't you just, first of all, a lot of our listeners might not know what Mountain Stage is. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how you got it started?
Mountain Stage is a two-hour-long radio show that features live music, and it has for, we'll be 24 years old in December. So we've been doing this that long, and it features music from all around the world. We have the widest variety of styles of music of any live show anywhere on radio or TV, and we always have. In other words, we can have an African band, we can have an old-time fiddler, we can have the Kronos Quartet, and these are all things we've had.
Yeah.
Or we could have a singer-songwriter who just wrote a big hit for Nora Jones. You know, maybe we could have all of these people. Or we could have Nora Jones, which we have.
Yeah.
And we've been the first to have a lot of different people who later became famous, including people like Bare Naked Ladies and Lyle Lovett and, you know, Ani DiFranco, a whole lot of people. I guess like two dozen or so. Sarah McLachlan, who were on Mountain Stage before anybody knew them. And in fact, it was their first national media appearance. So we've done this for a long time, and we do 26 shows a year. And now we're also on television, too, starting in January. We've been on before. We're going back on in television. And this is all on public broadcasting, radio and TV.
So how do you get picked up for the television? Just depends on
the stage. We give it away. So the public television station, if they want it, they can have it, because we give it away. We have underwriters. So like most public television shows these days, you don't get paid much to do it. I mean, they want it for free.
Yeah.
So we'll offer it and see how many people take it. Last time we were on, which we had to stop doing it 3 years ago, we ran out of money. We had about 240 stations. We had a station in L.A., a station in San Francisco TV. We've been on radio in L.A. and San Francisco before, but not now, various times. Public broadcasting stations change their format. They change their, you know, we're on, we're off, whatever. We have about 105 stations right now, affiliates.
That's great.
And we're on XM satellite, and we're on Voice of America around the world. And then you can go to our site and listen, mountainstage.org. You can hear shows that we refer you to another place, and there's like 20 shows you can listen to.
So tonight you have actually a pretty good array of genres that you're looking
right,
at.
Right, we do.
So how did you go about like booking tonight's show? Or how do you
Every show is booked. I'm the artistic director, so I pick who's going to be on the shows. And it's a combination of artistic direction and practicality. I mean, who we can get, and then who we want to put that we can get on that show. And usually we get an act. I try to be appropriate to where we're going to be. Our show is usually in an auditorium setting in Charleston, a nice small 500-seat auditorium. But we travel a lot. We're on the road here in a very small venue. So
right.
I had to take that in consideration. We're not going to put on Soul Live that's loud as hell here, because it makes no sense.
Yeah.
You know, and plus here the setting and everything calls for something, to me at least, a little bit more acoustic, a little bit more
definitely.
You know, that fits the place.
I mean, yeah, it's like really organic.
Yeah, we did a show in Town Hall in New York in May, and there we had Joan Osborne and Nellie Mackay and the Roaches and very urban kind of things.
Right.
But here it's more rural, and it's, you know, and I wanted to have a taste of West Virginia, so we put on two of West Virginia's best musicians, Johnny Statz and Robert Schaefer, mandolin and guitar player. But then I wanted to have something a little exotic, so we got a group, Les Jour Noir, from France, that do a combination of klezmer gypsy music. They're two brothers that play kind of gypsy-style fiddle. And they go all over the world. They're kind of high-powered instrumentals and sing in French.
Yeah.
And then we got a group called King Wilkie, which is it's a bluegrass band, but they've evolved into something a little different than straight bluegrass. They started more straight bluegrass. Now they don't do jazzgrass or newgrass, but they do stuff that's almost more songwriter-ish.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the things that are more atmospheric, but they have the bluegrass instrumentation, but not necessarily fast.
Right.
You know, songs that are more introspective in a sense.
Yeah.
And then we have Ray Wiley Hubbard, who's a very entertaining singer-songwriter. He tops the Americana charts all the time. He's from Texas, and he's very funny, too.
Yeah.
Very funny. And then we have a guy from Nashville who I think is one of the people that could be well known in a few years. His name is John Paul White, and he's just a good singer-songwriter. Not a country, he's from Nashville, but he's not a country guy.
Right.
His stuff is much more like AAA, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, that's that kind of music, adult, alternative.
Right. So do you find it exciting when you, like, when you're looking at someone like John Paul White tonight that could get, you know, pretty big, or like people like Norah Jones you've had on before? Mm-hmm. Does that excite you that you kind of gave them one of their first
shows? It's fun to be able to, it's what's fun is to be able to introduce these people to a wider audience. That's fun. I mean, you know, if they're great, I mean, listen to Norah Jones, you didn't have to be a genius to know that something was going to happen. Same way, there are people I heard, I got the CDs in, I listened to them one time, and I called Andy, who's our executive producer, and I said, let's get them right now.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, chances are we're not going to get them, because they'll get big quickly and they may not want to do our show. We're a pretty modest show. So, I mean, that I did that with Sheryl Crow. Mm-hmm. We put her on a show that we already had full, but I said, let's put her on the show anyway.
Let's get her.
It was our 300th anniversary show. We already had on that show the Bodines and the Violent Femmes.
Okay.
And we put on Sheryl Crow, who no one had ever heard of.
Yeah.
We put her on that show. And the same was true with Counting Crows. I listened to them and I said, get them on the show now. So we did. They never come back, but you know, neither is Sheryl Crow, but a lot of people do. A lot of them do come back. But when they get real big, it's hard to come and do a little show like ours, because it costs some money.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't have the and sometimes their management thinks that they look at us and think, it's a small time show. We don't do that anymore. But then other people don't think that way. We've had a lot of people who call, when you see big names on our show, like R.E.M., Martina McBride, these are people that are, Dierks Bentley recently, big country star, they called us. We didn't call them because they feel like this show has a certain integrity, a certain history, a certain thing that they want to be involved with. And they don't need us. They're going to sell records without us. They're going to get popular and make money without us. But for whatever reason, they want to be a part of our show, which is great.
Well, and when you look at your audience, your live audience, who are those people? Do you have a lot of regulars that always just come? They say, we know Larry's going to do this.
Yeah, in Charleston, we have a certain number of regulars, but not a lot. Maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen, who go to a lot of shows. And they go because they learn that, and we have others that probably that go to half a dozen shows a year or something like that, and they I know because they tell me that you know, they don't know the artists that are on the show. Most of the artists that come on our show you can't hear on radio in Charleston, no way. And first of all, radio these days, as you know, commercial radio
it's very
pretty awful.
I mean,
it's
pretty
horrid.
Payola concept,
even in big
away.
Cities it's pretty horrid. I mean, you might find a few stations that are halfway decent. Most of them are just horrible, and they're all programmed by the same guy somewhere.
Well, even here, I mean, and I do admittedly love Justin Timberlake, but I heard his one song on a radio station here yesterday or the day before yesterday about 6 times. I wasn't in the car very much. I mean,
don't worry, that wasn't programmed here.
No,
that choice wasn't made in Fayetteville, West Virginia.
Oh, yeah,
believe me, it was made in Minneapolis or Dallas or Los Angeles.
Yeah, like Clear Channel,
exactly.
Yeah, and it's just,
and that doesn't mean that it's automated, but it might be. And even if it isn't, they look at the playlists that are given to them and they don't change them very much, if they change them at all. So anyway, we're able to, since we don't live and die by numbers, we're not a commercial venture. So we want to have listenership, we want to have people come to the show, but we don't live and die by that like commercial people do. You know, if it goes down 1 point, everybody's fired, you know, that kind of deal. That's not the way it is here. We have a little more freedom, which is great. It means we have less money because we're not in that world, but we trade it for that. I mean, if you live in West Virginia, you often trade money for things that are better than money.
I would say so, just looking around.
Yeah.
For sure.
It is better than money. And living here is better than being rich. I mean, it's a great place. And because of the individuals. I saw something in the paper today about the happy. They had a thing about somebody's doing research on the happiest countries.
Uh-huh.
Happiest. They have these 50 questions, you know, whatever. And they, you know, they said Denmark is the happiest country. And America's in the top 15, but it's not in the top 10 or whatever. But some of the questions I looked at, I mean, some of them are typical things, you know. But one of them was a great one. It's like, do you feel that the people around you are good people, helpful people? Anybody in West Virginia would say yes to that.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's the way it is. So anyway, that's why I like it here, and I like to do shows here, and I like to work out of here. And when people come here, artists that are much well-known, or artists that aren't necessarily big stars, but they have a buzz, they have a, you know, they're happening, they're hip, whatever it is. And, you know, some of them have an attitude, and people are making a fuss about them and everything, but they come here and it kind of disarms them, because it's West Virginia. I mean, like, you know, nobody's trying to get you, nobody's trying to get something from you, nobody's trying to, you know, steal your stuff, nobody's trying to look at you and be critical, like, you know, the critics are going to kill me if I do something.
Yeah.
But they care. They feel like it's just a regular place. It's like playing in your house. I mean,
yeah.
And so they act like regular people. We have had warnings many times that, watch out, this person's very temperamental, blah, blah, blah. And they come here and they weren't temperamental with us.
So how did you said, like, the CDs will come to you and...
How they come, we send them, the artists, the managers, record companies, publicists, agents, all of those people send us CDs. And they service us in a big way. So there's like, I don't know, maybe a month, 200 a month or something. And, you know, a lot of them you can dismiss quickly. And then there's a lot that are kind of in between. And then some you definitely want, you know already, because you know them. They've been on the show before. And I try to listen to all of them that I can. And I don't. I have other people listen to some. And try to. It's really difficult because, you know, you only have a certain number of people you can put on in a year.
Yeah.
We can only put on 5 times 25. 125 people new every year that we can put on, and some of those are going to be people who have been on before. Some of them are going to be people that are well known, but that still leaves maybe 25 or 30 that you could put on that no one's ever heard of,
yeah,
that you think are good. Maybe they come on and disappoint, but most of the time they don't. Most of them they come on and they're even better than I thought they would be. So,
yeah,
you know, that's nice, and that's one of the ways I pick it. It's hard to tell how I pick a show because it's kind of organic. And every show is different. If I get an act that's kind of well known, or somebody that has a strong flavor, then I get them first. Then I try to put on things that will work with them, not that are like them, but that will work with them. I try to do that, you know. And they have different ways that I think that music matches.
Yeah.
Some music, like King Wilkie and Les Jours Noirs, play different kind of music, but they both have fiddles. They both have strong instrumental, you know, and they both have strong flavors of the culture they come out of. You know, whether it's klezmer and gypsy or whether it's bluegrass and Appalachian, those are strong flavors that use some similar instruments, your guitar and fiddle at least. So I figure that can go together on a show.
Right. That's cool.
Sometimes it's as simple as that. Sometimes it's more complicated about how I put them together.
So there won't be necessarily a headliner?
Not necessarily. Sometimes there is.
Yeah.
But not, I mean, when Martina McBride called us, obviously she's going to be a headliner. Because she does it. Arlo Guthrie, you know, wants to do the show. Arlo will probably be the headliner.
Right.
You know, but we may have people on that arguably, and Arlo would say, oh, these people are just like me, you know.
Yeah.
And we did on that show. We had two other veterans. We had John Hammond, and we had Jorma Kalkinen on the same show, both of whom are veterans, just like Arlo. They're both people in their early 60s, you know.
Yeah.
And they've been playing for 40 years, and they've, you know, they haven't gotten it. They didn't have hit songs like, well, Jorma did, but he was from the Jefferson Airplane. But Hammond never has, but he's played with everybody, knows everybody, and he's been around forever. So Arlo talked about that. He said, you know, these are the kind of people. He said, if you survived as long as we have, you know, guys like us, then you've pretty much figured out a way to survive in the industry.
Yeah. So I guess what's interesting to me, just in a lot of the shows I cover, a lot of times the reason that someone's opening for someone else is a label or a management or something like that. Mm. So it seems like your show actually gets out of that.
Absolutely.
Which is wonderful.
Well, it's 100% out of it. And I'll tell you another reason why. It's because I had a hit song one time.
Okay.
A long time ago. And when I did, it was a weird song. So I got a lot more coverage than I should have got. It was top 10 song in America. But because it was odd and funny and strange, that it was called Junk Food Junkie.
Okay.
And so because of that, I mean, it was like Dr. Demento's song of the year, 1976. So it got a lot more recognition than it would have had it been a normal love song that was number 9 on the Billboard charts.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to be on Tonight Show, American Bandstand, The Midnight Special, Merv Griffin Show, all of these shows, and everything down to Dr. Demento and Prairie Home Companion, all kinds of shows. And so because of that, I experienced what it was like to have a fleeting moment of, you know, like when somebody thinks you're happening in some way. And what and the shows that I was on, I took the things that I liked about the shows that I was on and I made them part of Mountain Stage, the stuff that I hated. So that's why, number one, the headliners and the openers, quote unquote, are not delineated like that.
Yeah.
Nobody gets a big dressing room, the other person gets a piece of crap, and nobody gets 40 minutes and the other person gets 2 minutes.
That's great.
It's not like that. Now, certainly there'll be some times when we give somebody 25 minutes and somebody else 15 or 18, mm-hmm. but that's not much different. No one gets to do only one song, no one ever on this show. Unless they want to do a 15-minute song, then they can. No one is ever told what to sing or what not to sing on this show. All we do is give you a time and say, I'd like you to do between 15 and 20 minutes. And then if you want to do one song, that's fine. We had Nellie McKay on. She did 9 songs in 22 minutes. And the record was 9 songs in 18 minutes by They Might Be Giants. But we've had, you know, people do 2-minute songs if they want. They do 12-minute songs if they want. I don't care. And the whole point is, I don't want to say, you have a hit song, come on, do that song, leave.
Right.
Because that's not what we're about. We're not about hit songs.
Right.
We're about music that people care about, the artists care about. So we give total artistic freedom, biggest of anybody. That's what we do, and that's why the show is set up like this. And really, personally, open. Sometimes there's a few people that don't get this, very few, but only a few that don't get it. Some managers don't. We've had one recently, I'm not going to tell you who it is, but somebody that you would know the name, whose manager, they pulled, she dropped out of the show 5 days ahead of time because we had her book, we had her first on the show. And so the manager, I said, look, this is a radio show. First and last are the best slots. Mm-hmm. It isn't like a concert where first is this nobody and last is the king.
Right.
First on this show means you think they're good enough that people will stay listening. If you have a bad act first, people tune out.
Yeah.
So I said,
it's your hook.
So in my opinion, you know, some of the strongest acts have to be first and last. And there really aren't any. Since people's radio habits are 20 minutes at a time, you don't know when they're going to tune. It's not like going to a concert where you get there and you see the first act. You might be listening starting at 20 minutes in or the last 20 minutes. It doesn't make any difference. So that was idiotic. But most people in the business, 99%, understand how we do it and why we do it. And the first act on the show is not the opener, and neither is the second act. You know, it's a matter of how we try to program so that it has some dynamics.
Right. Musically for you, do you still jam? Do you still play? Or
I still play a little bit, but you know, music, I don't listen to a lot of music for pleasure at this point.
Right, yeah, it's a lot of work,
yeah.
I'm sure.
I know, everything I listen to has to do with business, usually. And I still play with the band sometimes, but very seldom. And I still do some projects. Somebody called me the other day, I may do an album, believe it or not, but I do an album of hymns. I've done it before, and somebody wants me to do an album of hymns, which I like to sing. So I may do that, but I don't really have time. Because I'm ahead of this, I'm ahead of TV, I'm ahead of radio, and I'm also ahead of a festival in Charleston. So put that together, and then I have a kid 5-year-old and a kid 2-year-old. So I don't have time to be a singer, songwriter.
All right. As far as, we talked about radio a little bit, and the state of it, and it's pretty ridiculous at this point. Overall, music's been talked about in general as being in some sort of crisis at this point where the business, it's become difficult basically for artists like you're having here to actually sell records or even make records other than producing themselves and things like that. Do you have any perspective on just the music industry in general right now?
Sure. It's finally, the music industry has always been pretty rotten. But now it's being exposed as being almost totally rotten. Because what it is now is just ball-faced, all we want is somebody that sells 5 million records. And that's it. You deliver, I don't care what you are, I don't care who you are, you are a can of beans. I couldn't care less about anything else. Now, it was always that way a great deal, but before they made pretensions of like, oh, we're here for the artists. We, you know, which was BS, of course. But they were there for the artists until you didn't sell, and then that's the end of you.
Yeah.
But that's business. I mean, I understand that. I'm not even against that. It's just that now it's more open. And also it's more open how they've kind of gouged the public for a long time. And people understand that, and they get tired of it. And that's why the sales of CDs and stuff, one of the reasons why they're going down. Plus, I mean, one of the reasons are, by and large, you know, they're either it's a hit or miss. You either have an artist that sells 10 million copies, or else if they miss, if they're the American Idol that misses, then they sell nothing because they're no good. I mean, even the one that hits isn't very good, in my opinion, but somebody likes them. But the ones that misses are really worthless. I mean, they're like Michael Vick's dogs that didn't win. They'd drown them if they could, but instead they just don't hire them. They just get rid of them. So that's about as much respect as they get. And the only saving grace now, which was different than when I came up, is that if you do play a lot, if you're out playing 150, 250 gigs a year, and you can sell 8 records at each gig, and you can turn them onto your website or let them sell there. So if you could sell 5,000 to 8,000 CDs a year yourself, you can make a lot more money than I made for having a hit song. So that's good, because you do have a chance, a fighting chance of reaching somebody if you're willing to work at it. And I mean really work at it, physically work, by going on the road, and that's a lot of work.
Yeah, sure. It's a crazy lifestyle. I mean, even last night we were up, you know, really late, kind of doing that whole, and then, you know, up early. And
that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And people don't understand. I mean, you have the skills of a moving van operator, but then you have to have some late night skills, and you have to have, you know, I mean, you've got to be able to survive this and stay healthy at the same time, which is not easy. You know, either you know how to manage all of your drinks and whatever you do, or else you don't last very long because you burn out quickly. You find people that come around over 50 and they're either clean and sober or else they're about to die. I mean, one of the two. I mean, they're under control. Let's put it that way. They may not be clean and sober, but they're under control.
Yeah.
Or they ain't got long
for
this world.
They're never
going to
get it. Yeah.
I mean, they'll be gone by the time
sure.
they're 60. And that's, I'm not even joking. That's
no.
really, you know, so that's one of those deals that I think is a fact. And anyway, I think that there are more opportunities now, which is actually very good for the average band. And still, people want to break. But if you're not totally driven by fame and big money, and all you want to do is earn a living, I think you have a better chance of earning a living now than you did 30 years ago or 40 years ago. Because then it was either zero or a million. You know.
Yeah.
Now you might have a chance to have 30,000. You know, which. If you don't mind doing it, and this is what you love anyway, then perhaps
right.
you're willing
to
do that.
If you're really doing it for the music.
Yeah, if you really love to do it, and you really get you get a kick out of it, you still get a thrill out of it, you get fun out of it, you get some satisfaction, and you enjoy it, and you feel like you're still growing and moving, and it's rough to have a family that way. It's very difficult, but they're, traveling salesmen, a lot of people have the same problems.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're away from home a lot, it's tough to have a family.
It is, yeah.
That's just one of those deals.
Well, I have, a few questions that I like to ask
right.
everyone just
Shoot.
Related to their first experience with music. So, what was the first album that you bought?
The first single I bought was, it was given to me. I wanted it. It was Sun Records' Blue Suede Shoes by Coral Perkins, and I think Hey Good Lookin' was on the other side.
Huh. Yeah.
And I may be wrong about that, but I think it was. And my mom bought me that when I was about 6 years old, I think 7 years old. First cool. album I bought, that's a good question. I can't remember whether it was a country record or it might have been like commercial folk record, like Kingston Trio or something
okay.
like that, or it might have been a country record. And then quickly I moved in. I bought Dylan's first record when
oh,
I was 13,
wow.
and first album.
Cool.
And then I liked that a lot. From there I quickly moved into the more organic kind of folk stuff. I mean, I went to New Lost City Ramblers and then to Flat and Scruggs and to more country and Woody Guthrie and things like that. So it was like more traditional folk and country stuff. Then I started buying those records.
Great.
You know, pretty quick, but that was when I was 14, maybe.
And what was the first concert that you remember you went to?
I'm trying to think of once again. When I was in high school, I went to see Dylan. In the
wow.
band, when the band was still playing. He played the first set by himself and second with the band. And I went to see Johnny Cash when the Statler Brothers opened for him. And I really liked those. I think I went to see the Kingston Trio too in Dallas. Might be even before those. Might have been before though, because I was very young teens at that point. And of course, I bought Beatles, the first Beatles record too, Meet the Beatles. I mean, that was in the eighth grade, so I think. I can't remember how old it was, but it was eighth, ninth, grade, something like that.
Yeah.
And that was great too. I mean, I love that. It was super. I wasn't into much of the kind of the bubblegum pop stuff. You know, I was more into the Elvis and Carl Perkins and that sort of thing, and then transitioned into stuff that was more folksy. I mean, I bought Ian and Sylvia. I really liked that duo. Love them. Still, they have had them both on the show.
Really?
Yeah. It's great. Ian Tyson, have him on the show and watch him. We did, for the ending song, we did Four Strong Winds, which is great. You know, Gab wrote the song. It's great. We've had some of that stuff where we do a finale song.
Uh-huh.
And most of the time it's a song, either it's very easy or you may have a chance of knowing it or nobody knows it, but it's so easy that you can pick it up in a minute. But every now and then we have certain artists on and I'll ask them if we can do one of their songs because they have to be huge. I mean, it has to be something.
Yeah.
Like we had P.F. Sloan on the other day, so we did... Secret Agent Man for the
oh,
ending song.
Okay.
And we've done, we did Working in a Coal Mine with Alan Toussaint when he was on.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
Yeah. And we did,
That's
you know,
great.
We did Wild Thing with Chip Taylor. we did a Randy Newman song when he was on.
That had to be
Rider,
fun anyway.
Rider on the Range, yeah. Which is a great story because I said, okay, we're going to do this song, Randy, you care? He goes, no, that's great, man. I said, you play the piano. Okay, so we just run through it once, you know, it's always rough. We just run through
yeah.
it. Yeah. So that's it, we're done. He goes, oh, man, I like your style. Lower our standards and forge ahead. I
That's been one of our credos since then. Lower our standards and forge ahead.
Because, you know, the ending song, that's what we do. We just want it to be weird, rough, and everything. And right. Not all of it gets on the show. It's great. People love it. I mean, the audience loves it, and people... I used to try to make it perfect because you're not going to get it.
I think it's another thing, too, that just makes your show accessible, right? And yeah. Just make, right. Because it's
loose. It's a little funky, you know. We mix it down to two track from multi-track to two. We don't have any in between. We don't remix.
Okay.
The engineer has to perform just like the artist does.
That's great.
Got to get it right the first time.
Yeah.
There ain't no safety net on mountain stage. Never has been. Yeah. And so, but you listen to the recordings. Listen to the recordings, and a lot of people. There's Robert and Johnny.
Okay.
But it's fun. And there's been a lot of others whose songs, you know, they wrote songs that. And Ian Tyson was one who, he just said, "Gosh," I said, "you mind if we sing a song?"
Yeah.
We sing "Amazing Grace" with Joan Baez, you know.
Wow.
And I just said, "Would you mind if we do this song, you know, with you?" And they say, "I don't know about that." And we've had some great experiences doing that.
Wow.
People
that's cool.
And it's been a lot of people like that. People who's, and once again, Joan Baez is a record I bought very early. I mean, probably one of the first 10 records I bought. Yeah, so those are some of the early influences for me.
That's cool. All right, two more.
Yeah.
What was the first instrument you learned to play?
Guitar. My mom gave me a guitar when I was 13. F-hole K, big arch top F-hole. And too bad I got rid of that car. I traded it in on another guitar. But she gave me that when I was 13.
Cool. And the first song that you learned to play, other than like the
That's
typical
good question.
Ode to Joy and all that, but like...
Yeah, no, I didn't learn. I didn't learn any of that stuff because I didn't take lessons. I learned from other people. So we were learning how to play, you know, the folky songs of the day, Don't Think Twice, and some more commercial ones like Tom Dooley, you know, or whatever, those kind of tunes.
Cool.
Greenback Dollar, those kind of songs that were either commercial folk or... Peter, Paul, and Mary, you know,
right.
that's the very first ones I learned.
Cool.
And my dad taught me some tunes. I shouldn't say that. The very first ones I learned from my grandfather and my dad, the very first ones were like Red River Valley and those kind of songs that, because my dad could play the guitar a little, my grandfather played the fiddle, so I would play a little of that, Red River Valley and On Top of Old Smokey and those kind of songs.
Cool. Great.
Are great songs.
Yeah. No, definitely.
They were there.
Yeah.
I recorded a bunch of songs for Walt Disney. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, okay.
I made 9 albums for them, for children. And
I actually, when I was reading your bio, yeah. I read some of those.
Four of them are still for sale. You can Google Disney's children's favorites, and you can buy them on Amazon right now. Still, the first one I made was 30 years ago, so they're phasing them out, but they're still for sale.
I remember as a kid we had a couple Disney records.
Probably was me.
I bet
Quite possible. It's Disney's children's favorites. Had 25 songs
on
it.
Yeah, and it has the Magic Kingdom on there and like Mickey playing around on the album because it was a record.
Yeah.
I bet it was you then.
Quite possible.
That's great.
I mean, we sold these records, sold tens of millions of records.
Actually, yeah. We were looking the other day for this one specific one we had on cassette. But
it's possible. It could have been something else, but it could have been me.
Yeah,
I mean, you're the
out,
age that it could
home.
Have been because
yeah.
you're probably 20 years younger than me, at
yeah.
least, maybe 30. And,
yeah,
and
I'm
it's
28, so.
Yeah, you're 30 years younger than me.
All right.
So. That makes sense because I made them when I was in my mid-20s and they sold a lot. And there were ultimately four volumes, volume 1, 2, 3, and 4. And each of them had at least 25 songs. And most of them were just folkies. I mean,
yeah,
you know, On Top of Old Smokey.
But they dropped in a few
of my songs. I wrote, that's how I made money on them, was they dropped in on every record at least 2 songs that I wrote. So I had 36 songs on their label. And there were songs, the ones that I wrote you would have never heard of before because, you know, I wrote them. They were, one of them is called I'm a Policeman, and one of them is The Mail Must Go Through. There were songs that, yeah, I wrote song.
Yeah.
Exactly.
By Post.
Exactly, right. That's me. I wrote that song.
Aeroplane.
Yeah, exactly. I wrote that song.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So write a letter to a friend
exactly.
and maybe he'll write
See?
You.
See, there you go.
Oh, that's
I
brilliant.
I wrote that song.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
It's too bad that Becky wasn't here to hear that.
That's great. Oh, my God.
Did you hear that?
This is so awesome.
I was telling her about my Disney records.
Yeah.
And she said, wait a minute. And I said, and they always put some of my songs. I said, I had one on the first record, I'm a Policeman. The other was The Mail Must Go Through. She started singing it.
Yeah.
Oh!
For sure. Yeah. I can't wait to tell my mom this one. But
I've been to schools before. I used to play in schools and I would sing for like, you know, school. And I'd sing and I'd start singing one of my songs, like those songs. And kids would sing along. I said, how'd you know that? And I didn't even know. Some of them were in the Silver Burdette series for third graders. Disney didn't tell me. They paid me, but they didn't tell
right,
me it's going to be in the book.
I
didn't look. I mean, I didn't look at the breakdown of what the payment was, and I just realized it was in the Silver Burdette. And to me, that's a bigger thrill than having a huge hit song, because you affect, like, how she knew this song that I wrote.
That's crazy.
I wrote that song in 1976. and she knows that song today. That's really great. Wow. I mean, I love that. That to me is I think that's a wonderful thing.
So
my kids like the records.
That's so funny.
You know, which is pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's great.
They sold tens of millions of copies. They're phasing out finally, but they lasted for a long time.
Huh. That's awesome.
You'll have to have those books. You don't have the books? I hope you do.
I got Silver Bidet book. Yeah, okay, I got a copy of that. But the records, and I have a copy of all the records. I'm buying some more now because they won't be available probably 5 years from now is my guess. 30 years is a long time for a record to be on sale.
Oh, you know.
But they still like it. I still get emails from kids and people. You know,
great.
We like to hear you sing. The same with hymn records are the same way. I've made records. I have hundreds of letters of people get comfort from this stuff, you know, because, you know, hymns are wonderful.
Makes it.
I mean, hymns heal people. They get you through hard times. It always has. I mean, that's why they're here. So that's the best thing. I'd rather people know me for that than, because that helps people, actually.
Yeah.
Hit songs make people money, and 2 years, it's like junk food, you know. 3 weeks later, you forgot that, and what's the next one, you know. But certain things stay with you, like the mail must go through. And they do stay with you.
Sure.
And that's great. I mean, all those songs you learn, you know, Stop Smoking. That's why I say those are great songs. And playing them, we recorded those songs in Nashville, and the musicians thought it was wonderful because they never get to record those songs.
Mm-hmm.
They play there every day with hit songs from Nashville. But here they were getting to record On Top of Little Smokey and Oh Susanna, which everyone loves.
Yeah.
And you can make fun of it, you can joke about it, but everyone loves these songs.
And everyone knows them, too.
In Africa, they know it. I mean, you know, like, play Oh Susanna in China, they'll know it. Yeah, in Russia, they'll know it. Africa, there'll be somebody that knows that song.
Right.
Which is astounding. It's
it
amazing.
It is.
Because it's a real song. It has lasted not because somebody hyped it, but because it's actually very good.
Yeah, no one
There's something
to...
basic about it. Or else it would be disappear. Even the mail go through has something basic that you remember. About,
right,
you know,
for sure.
It's not going to be Oh Susanna. It won't be here 100 years from now, but it's nice that somebody remembers it.
Yeah.
And I have that happen quite often.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. All right, well, Larry, looking forward to the show tonight.
Good.
And definitely, listeners, check it out online. I'm going to give the website again.
Yeah, it's just real simple. Mountainstage, one word, mountainstage.org. And
okay.
it'll get to our website. You can listen to the shows there and find out if you live near us or if we're going on the road, find out how you might go to one live. But you can also have access to, I think now we got about 12 of them on there, something like that, of the recent shows.
Great.
Okay. So,
well, thank you so much, and welcome once again to Mountain Stage.